establishing. So there is a notion of via baguette, and we'd like to try to go a little bit further to understand just how it works before working on the details. And one of the important things to remember, and also it's worth trying to figure out how this is true, that the Shulchan Aruch makes it clear that there are a couple of levels, that there are situations in which we are kofe on a get, in which Beis Din, its representatives, can compel the giving of a get, and there are other situations which are somewhere in between, where we say mitzvah legarish. So that's going to be an important distinction practically. It's one that's very relevant nowadays. Nowadays, Bat Din address these kind of situations all the time, and it becomes really a big project sometimes to analyze, because it has tremendous ramifications, to analyze the psak of a certain Beis Din versus another Beis Din. Different Bat Din have different styles in the way they express themselves, and very often they will adjudicate a matter between a husband and wife, and they'll use language which may constitute a psak of kviya, and it may constitute something less. So since we know that there are these different tiers, there's kofin, and there's mitzvah, and there's perhaps even all kinds of ambiguous language in between, so it's important just to be aware of that for its practical implications, which we'll say more about. But it's also conceptually important, because we're trying to figure out how does kfiya work, and why does kfiya work? So we started to discuss yesterday that it may be a straight progression from kfiya al ha-mitzvos. That was certainly the way the Ksos was defined, that it's a function of kfiya al ha-mitzvos, which led us to discuss what mitzvah is it. And we talked a little bit about, is it be'ahavta l'reicha kamocha? Is it mitzvah l'shmoa divrei chachamim, which had all kinds of implications. So what do we make of the fact that we could say it's a mitzvah from the Beis Din and still say that's not kofin? You follow the question that if the kofin is based on the mitzvah, so how come sometimes we have kofin and sometimes we have mitzvah without kofin? So we have to figure out what that means, and that's a topic down the line, but just something that's important to keep in mind. And again, practically speaking, so for example, if you're asked on occasion to come to a rally or something like that because of a messy get situation, it's not necessarily to be assumed that that's a function of kfiya. That may not rise to kfiya, and that might be an instance where the Beis Din may or may not have paskin kfiya in such a case. So it's just, as we move along this topic, it's important to be aware that we have to recognize there are possible distinctions, that some of what you see going on today is not necessarily working under the assumption of kfiya. Sometimes there is a psak of kfiya, and sometimes there isn't. And does that affect what you're allowed to do and what you're not allowed to do? Yes, important practical questions. But also, just as far as the concept, so if kfiya is based on the mitzvah, so it's interesting to take note of the fact that you can have mitzvah without kfiya. It's also interesting, which you got a chance to see a little bit, that the Gemara in Gittin and the Rishonim build on this a little bit more, tells us that in order to have kfiya for a get, so we need dayanim smuchim, we need ordained dayanim, and nowadays, and always the days outside of Eretz Yisrael, we don't really have dayanim smuchim. So that's an issue, not just for this, but for other things as well. For all practices of din, it's theoretically at least the starting issue. The Gemara tells us that there is a concept of shluchu saivu, that dayanim who are not actually themselves smuchim, we don't nowadays have smicha at all. No offense to the wonderful program here at Yeshiva, but those of you who are signed up for it, but not to denigrate that in any way, but the smicha that we call smicha nowadays is not the historical smicha. Historical smicha means that you have ish mipi Moshe Rabbeinu, so we have to have that chain of smicha in order to fully qualify as a member of the Sanhedrin and the like. So the Gemara says that even without that, there are certain things for which we use a mechanism called shlichu saihu. Now, what does shlichu saihu mean? It's not our subject for today, but again, just to be aware, it sounds, if you translate the word directly, it sounds like it's some form of shlichus, that somehow the idea is that the actual ordained dayanim, even though today none of them are alive, but somehow the actual ordained dayanim impart their power to other individuals around the world to to act on their behalf. And that since there is a home base of smuchim, so there are others who can function with that authority, with their permission. So that's what it sounds like from the word shlichusayu. Rav Schechter has written about this at length. Others discuss this. It's very possible it's not what it means. It's not about shlichus. It's about a different concept. So it's not really our sugya for today, what exactly shlichusayu means. It is a Sanhedrin dot base sugya, so then come back next year, and it's worth a lot more attention. But just so we understand enough to work within our sugyas, we have some type of mechanism that allows non-smuchim to function as a bezdin nowadays for certain purposes, for certain limited purposes, certain things that we're able to accomplish that require a bezdin, so shlichusayu allows us to accomplish that, and there are things that we cannot accomplish nowadays. So for example, it's relevant to other parts of Ksuvus, so the Torah's knossos, the Torah's penalties, as distinct from rabbinical penalties, which is a different story, but the knossos that we read about, like Onus and Mefata, the knossos that we read about in our Masechta, so those we don't do nowadays because we don't have Bezdin Smuchim. We don't have Malkus nowadays because we don't have Batei Din Smuchim. We do have basic Dinei Mamonos adjudicated because that we do use Shlichusayu. So there are some things that Shlichusayu is able to accomplish and some things that they aren't. Again, it's a longer discussion, but apparently because of Shlichusayu, we are able to have Batei Din function in order to be Kofa again. So that's also important just to consider or keep in the back of your mind. If you want to ask the question, what exactly is the role of Bezdin? Is the Bezdin there in an evaluative role? Or is it there just to assess that there is some pre-existing mitzvah? Or is it there to address the Ratzon question? So all of those are good possibilities, but the fact that we need not just a smart Bezdin, but a Bezdin of a certain degree of authority, that's an interesting point to consider. An interesting point to be aware of. Now, it's also an important detail to have in the mix. We started to mention yesterday, so we know there are certain cases where the Gemara tells us it could be kofa on a get. Many of them are in our Masechta on Daf Ayin Zayin, but not all of them. So a few other Gemaras, Yerushalmis, so on today's list are some of the other cases. So for example, the Gemara in the Sefer Yevamos talks about, let's say, if there are no children. So let's say the wife comes and complains that she doesn't have children. So the Gemara says, well, as far as the mitzvah component, it's not really her mitzvah, but as far as the companionship component, then she could have a valid taina, or the fact that she wants somebody to take care of her in her old age, the Gemara discusses. So there again, the Gemara brings up the possibility of telling the husband that he has to be forced to divorce her. So they're not all on this daf. There are a few other such cases. But it could be that if we look through the Bavli and the Yerushalmi and some of the Makoros that we saw on today's list, so we get a handful of situations where there is a rule of kfiyah. And then it's a question to ask, is that exhausted? Would we apply kfiyah to any case that's not identified in either the Shas, Bavli, or the Rishonim? So what do you see about that? What do Rishonim say about that? So one source I didn't put on the list because it would take a little while to find. There was enough else to put on. But the Rush in a few places, the Rush in his Chuvus and the Rush in his Pesachim, the Rush asserts, and other Rishonim assert this as well, that we only invoke kfiya in those cases that Chachamim have delineated. So let's say Chachamim meaning the Shas, Bavli, and Yerushalmi. And the Shulchan Aruch records that. Now, it may be that others may disagree. And on this issue, there is a very famous Rambam, which I put at the bottom of the list this morning because it's important to this topic, but it's also a segue into a future topic. So, but the bottom of the list is a good place for it. But it's maybe the second most famous Shitas HaRambam in Gittin. So the Kofin Rambam that we've already discussed and we'll say more about today. So that's a very well-known position of the Rambam. But there is another very important, very much discussed Rambam, which eventually, maybe after Pesach, we'll end up spending some significant time on. And that is his view on Moyes Alai. So I don't know if you got a chance to see this yet, and it's at the end of today's list. But the Rambam has a well-known position that if the wife says, Mois alai, if the wife says that to me, the husband is disgusting. I don't want to live with such a man. I find him to be personally repulsive. So then that's also a category where Beis Din will be kosher. So clearly that very greatly expands what's going to be in the list. Doesn't mean it necessarily includes everything, but it would seem to widen the circle significantly. And that's, again, one of the major issues that are debated today, the position of the Rambam versus the position of other Rishonim, that Mois Alai does not necessarily automatically trigger a psak of kfiyah. So this Rambam is very important, topic of a lot of discussion, and we'll have to see more about that.
Is that objective discussed or subjective?
So there's a lot to say about that, so again, that's why we'll have to figure out exactly what it means. But just for now, it's important to be aware of the position. It's also interesting because you have to figure out that if the Rambam is premised on the mitzvah component, so does that necessarily match here? So is Mois Alai a function of mitzvah? Maybe, maybe not. That'll also require a little bit more of a analysis.
Hi. And how is there any problems with today? Why they can't just end it? Or like, why do you have to go through the whole Lebanon process? I mean,
well, we have a lot of problems. First of all, as we'll discuss, again, this is a topic we'll have to get to, but the Rambam's position itself is very controversial. It seems like most of the Rishonim don't accept that, so that's a major issue. And then the second question is, even in Timsi Womer that we did Paskin like the Rambam, or let's say all the other cases which the Gemara is explicit about, so the question is, does kfiyah even exist as a possibility today? This is the subject of a major criminal case that's being prosecuted as we speak. The question of to what extent is kfiyah a functional, even in Timsi Womer that is justified, it's not addressing any of the cases that are being addressed right now, but let's say you could have a clear psak that it was justified. So we don't seem to have kfiyah possibility in America today, maybe not only as a function of practicality, but maybe even as a function of halacha, we might not have capacity kfiyah. Kfiyah may depend on certain circumstances which we don't have in America today. So we'll have to get to that. But so that short answer to your question is, if Mois Alai is subject to kfiyah, why do we have an aguna problem? So one answer is, a lot of the Rishonim don't agree with that premise. But secondly, even when kfiyah is the clear psak, we're held back in a lot of ways from actively practicing that. Okay, so let's try to address the question in a little bit more detail of how the mechanics work of kfiyah. And here it's interesting because in some discussions, some of the later discussions of this process of kfiyah, so they identify, say, four different approaches in the Rishonim as to how it works. One could ask if they're really four different approaches or if these statements overlap in significant ways. So I don't want to prejudice the issue by claiming that there are necessarily four different shittas. I'd like to ask you to consider how these different statements that you find in the Rishonim, how do they fill in a little bit about the puzzle about how this may work. And it could be that they're not necessarily arguing with each other. In some cases, there are points among these four positions that are at odds with each other, but they necessarily constitute four separate opinions. Not necessarily, maybe yes, maybe no. So you'll let me know what you think about that, whether or not they really are. So a lot of it revolves around a passage in the Gemara Maseches Bava Basra. So by now you've probably had a chance to see that Gemara in Bava Basra, and Daf Memches, where the Gemara talks about Tlihu V'Zavri. That let's say you were to force someone to sell something, which presumably is not permitted to do. It's important in general with a lot of these things, we have to keep our categories separate, that there are things that work and there are things that are permitted and they're not necessarily always the same thing. So when reading a Gemara like this about forcing someone to sell something, so you may wonder, so is this ethical behavior? So Pashtus not, and not only that, it's probably a violation of one of the Aseres HaDibros, right? So we have a prohibition of Lo Sachmod, the big machlokes, what exactly Lo Sachmod covers. But it seems pretty likely that if you pressure someone into selling something, and it sounds like it's an explicit gemara, that if you pressure someone into selling something and you pay for it, then that's still a violation of losachon. Yeah, it's a big machlokus rishonim, but let's assume that it's prohibited. So that's not the focus of this gemara. So maybe it's us and maybe it's not, but we're interested in isolating the issue, does it work? So the gemara over there has a discussion, is it effective if you pressure someone to sell something? And they do, so does the sale at least take effect? So the gemara notes that you could say, isn't really every sale about that? People, you know, this, you want to get to the psychology, talk about the endowment effect. I think we discussed this a little bit last semester. It came up for some reason that people don't want to part with what they have. Right? They've done studies that people will pay a certain amount for something, but that if you ask them to sell it, they'll ask for much more money because once you already have it, you don't want to get rid of it. So the Gemara is basically implying here that nobody ever wants to sell anything. Probably not true, but to some extent, nobody wants to sell what they have. The people want to hold on to what they have. So anytime you sell something, it's because you need the money. Right? So it's not because you really want to sell it. It's that you have external pressure. You need the money. So Nabuch, what can you do? You'll sell this item and you'll take the money. It's not a perfect world, but that's what happens, and that's how sales work. So if that's the case, says the Gemara, so then what's the question, school of Islam? So you see that everybody who sells because they have some type of pressure, and yet the sales are effective. Sales in general work, even though people are pressured to do it. So it must be that, yes, if you're forced to sell something, it's effective. So in that context, so the Gemara says, well, maybe that's not really comparable to what we're talking about here, that yes, you're pressured to sell, but still, once you do it of your own free will. You're making the decision yourself to sell. Things bringing you to that decision are external pressures, but that's not really the same thing as somebody else actually forcing you to do something. Right? It's this distinction, this whole gemara is very important for everything we've been talking about, because kind of breaking down, we've been talking about kfiya by mitzvos before this, and now talking about kfiya and gittin. So breaking down the different parts of a free will decision. Where is it something you're deciding to do? When do we say, well, in a perfect world, you wouldn't have done this, so therefore it doesn't count? This Gemara gives us a little bit of a clue, a little bit of an insight to the fact that we're all made up of complex motivations, and at some point we're happy, and at some point we're not so happy, and in some ways where it's a free will decision, and in some ways we feel it's not a free will decision. So you could break it down to a lot of different parts. So the Gemara is kind of addressing that. The Gemara is saying that, well, maybe let's say that every sale is a function of pressure because nobody would part with anything unless they had the financial pressure to do so. And then the Gemara says, well, it's not really comparable because still at the end of the day, you made your own decision, while if somebody forces you at gunpoint, so it's not your own decision. Right, we got into these distinctions also when we were talking about stucco. The last sentence we were talking about stucco, and we talked about avak gezel, and we talked about pressuring people to give stucco donations. This is all kinds of very narrow distinctions that, on the one hand, gezel would mean that somebody puts a gun to your head and says your money or your life. So even though you're deciding to give it to him, but it's because of the essentially no option because they're going to kill you otherwise. But we find that there's a concept of avak gezel, that there are less overt pressures, which also count as pressures. So it's all kind of a subtle distinctions along a spectrum. So the Gemara is highlighting that and saying maybe all selling is a pressure. But still, no, there's a difference between the selling that you decide to do at the end of the day, you chose to do it, as opposed to that which you mamish have no say in doing. And then the Gemara says, well, what about we find that there are certain ki'ilu transactions, which apparently you can be forced to do, and those must be effective. So in that context, the Gemara brings up the two things we've been talking about with kfiya, karbanos and gittin, and the Gemara has ways of saying, well, maybe they're not really such great proof. Right? So what does the Gemara say? So a karban maybe is not such great proof. Why not? Because the kapara maybe adds to the picture. And the get maybe is not such great proof. Why not? There the Gemara has the phrase, mitzvah l'shmoa divrei chachamim, that we spoke about yesterday. That maybe because you have that upside, that you get to follow the words of the Chazal, which is a tremendous chus, so that's not the same, that's not a model for any other type of transaction where that may not be present. So ultimately the Gemara concludes that there's a svara why such things work, and that essentially, however you get pushed to the situation, but once that's the case, you made a decision to go through with it, and therefore it's effective. So this Gemara is clearly very important in a lot of ways. It clues us into a lot of the svaras that are relevant to issues of coercion and transaction and the interaction between the two. And it throws in the phrase here, mitzvah l'shmoa divrei chachamim, in the context of get, although what is the impact of that is not clear, because the Gemara is basically bringing it as a dichoy, saying, well, maybe get is not a good source for transactions in general, because get draws on a mitzvah issue, and maybe other things don't. So how much of a role is that playing in the get kfiya? We don't know from this Gemara. We know that it's part of the discussion, and we don't know necessarily how much of a role it's playing. So the Gemara, on the surface, very important for all the elements of this issue. And then the question of what the Rishonim say about it. So on the daf in Baba Basra, you see two of our possible four shittas. And here especially, you could ask, are they really saying different things? So one is the Rashbam. Right? The Rashbam, fascinating point, very relevant to the contemporary discussion. And the Rashbam says that when it comes to get, so the reason it works is because essentially you're not losing anything. Right? This again parallels what we spoke about the other day when we're talking about kfiya and the chisar and kis component, the different reasons why it might be that Rashi Mechulin says that kfiya is invoked for mitzvah specifically when there's no loss of money. We mentioned there's a possible approach in that Rashi that kfiya is going to be more believable when we can say, listen, we're just pushing you to do something which doesn't have any downside for you. So to whatever extent the situation doesn't have a downside, kfiya seems to be more of a viable possibility. We talked about zachem al yadam, zachem al yadam in general, making somebody do something without their consent or against their consent is always more viable if there's no downside. So says the Rashbam. So here, there's no downside. It's fascinating the way he phrases it. Why is there no downside? And he says, because, on the one hand, no offense, she hates you. Right? She's not going to really hang out with you very much anyway. So you don't have much of a marriage. And since you don't have a marriage, so to stay married under those circumstances, there's no mileage. There's no advantage, and the only function of the get is to allow her to marry somebody else. Shmuley?
You have to pay the tzuah, also.
Correct, which is also interesting, and what exactly does that represent, and when does that apply also, that's a whole separate discussion. So,
no, but it's not going to be a downside for like
so age. It's a fair question, so there's so much that's involved with that, keep that question in the back burner for a while. But essentially, the act itself of the divorce, says the Rashbam, that can be forced because there's no downside. Because there's no practical marriage right now, and she hates him, and therefore, what kind of a life do they have together? So to allow her to marry someone else, that's not anything that he can logically oppose. One could invoke the terminology of Midas Tov, which is a whole other interesting discussion. One could discuss to what extent this figures in. And in general, this is more of a hashgafic point than a halachic point, but it's a little bit of a halachic point also, that we know that we have historical people who stone, who we're told in the Torah they get destroyed, and the only thing the Torah Shebichsad tells us, the Psukim tells us, is that they were just terrible people. They were terrible sinners. But we don't know exactly what was so terrible about them. But from Chazal, we find a couple of clues. And it's not just a homiletic, it's halachic, because the Gemara tells us there's a concept of kofin al midas stone, that we force someone not to act stone-like. And stone-like in the Gemara means that you want others not to benefit in a situation where it doesn't hurt you. There's an expression in the Gemara, zeh nene v'zeh lo chaser, that somebody else could benefit and it's not a cost to you, so why shouldn't they benefit? And it's used in different ways in different Gemaras, so without getting into that whole sugya, but at least in one Gemara that seems to be identified with this idea of kofen al midas stone, that we force you not to violate this principle that others benefit and you don't lose. You should allow that to happen, you should interfere. Again, there's different usages. Sometimes the Gemara is talking about stopping somebody from benefiting even though it doesn't hurt you. That's called midas stone. Elsewhere, where the Gemara is less explicit about the stone reference, the phrase that nenev zolachasa means somebody benefited and you want to charge them, even though you didn't actually lay out anything. And that's illegitimate. So a little bit less intense because your desire for money is understandable, but the point is there, you didn't do anything to earn it. But in other usages, there's no plus side for you at all. It's just about somebody else benefiting. So getting in the way of that, the Gemara calls that midas stone. So what extent that kind of thinking is a part of this Rashbam, it's not explicit here, but one could say, all right, the way he's painting the picture is he's saying, essentially, all that's at stake is her benefit, because there's no advantage to you right now the way things are. So all that's at stake is her being able to marry somebody else. So, therefore, there's nothing to stop us from being kofen. And again, it's just interesting that the word kofen, we do find in the concept of kofen, we find specifically towards midas stone, and the Rashbam, without exactly using these words, is basically saying that's what's an element here, that this is essentially a midas stone situation, because there's no upside for the husband staying the way things are, and all it is about providing a benefit for the wife. Hi.
Isn't there the additional thing that the Gemara mentions about getting the mitzvah listening to the rabbis?
So that's what we have to now figure out, and maybe this might be the next step of to what extent that plays a role. Again, from the Gemara, it's not obvious that that's an issue, because the Gemara mentions that as a difference between get and kinyanim. We don't know how active an element it is. Maybe it is a very important element, maybe it isn't an important element. We'll see more about that. So there are those who ask, you know, does this Rashbam fully explain everything? Let's say, for example, if the Gemara says that there could be kfiyah if there are no children and the wife wants a child, or something like that, or maybe in even halachic situations where it's a kohen married to a grusha, something like that. So there, the Rashbam's description doesn't fully apply. You know, it could be they have a very happy marriage. It could be that there's many wonderful things about their relationship, but there is this other element that's bringing about the kfiyah. So not every situation in which we've seen kfiyah as a possibility necessarily fits this description. Maybe this fits some of the more extreme cases that we talk about nowadays, but would just totally explain every case of kfiyah, you have to figure out if it's a perfect description. Certainly there are many situations that it applies to, but whether or not it's a fully comprehensive description, that's something to keep in the back of our minds as well. Okay, so statement number one, whether we call it different shittas or not, but statement number one is this Rashbam. Statement number two is Tosfos over there in that same omelet, where Tosfos essentially is asking a question. And is Tosfos really differing from the Rashbam? Personally, I'm not sure. Again, I've seen this counted as two different shittas. Could be they're addressing two different parts of the puzzle, so you can tell me what you think. And basically, Tosfos is asking that we have a different thing. That maybe tzlu v'zavin zvini, being forced to sell something, that is effective. But if you force someone to give a gift, so then that's not so effective. So asks Tosfos, how do you know that when it comes to a get, that this should be compared to selling something? Maybe this should be compared to giving a gift, in which case it's not effective. How do we know how to categorize this as a Zvini situation? Maybe it's a Matana situation. So what does Tosfos say? What concept does Tosfos invoke? And if you saw today's list, the Rashash, who expresses Tosfos in a little bit more detail. So basically, Tosfos on the surface says that since there is a mitzvah, that makes it a mechir situation rather than a matanah situation. And apparently, anytime there's a mitzvah involved, it should be categorized as mechir rather than matanah. And the Rashash, in the back of the Gemara, the Rashash fills that in a little bit more. The Rashash, by the way, was a very wealthy businessman, to whatever extent that informs his understanding of Mecher and Matana and the value of things. But the Rashash comments over there that mitzvos are worth money. Right? We happened to speak about this yesterday in a different context. We mentioned the idea of paying asar zehuvim, that if somebody steals your mitzvah, remember yesterday we talked about the case if somebody burns your chametz and deprives you of the opportunity to do it, or steals your bris milah, circumcises your son before you have a chance to do it. So the Gemara says in Chulin that under such circumstances, he's got to pay you. He's got to pay you a knas. The Chassam Sofer has a tshuva about somebody who played a practical joke on somebody else and said that he can come and give a bris milah to this person's son. And it turns out the whole thing was a joke. He had a daughter who just made the guy schlep out for nothing. So the Chassam Sofer said he should be punished for his onos devarim, for his practical joke here. And one of the things he says, he has to pay asar zehuvim. It seems to be a reflection of this idea also, that the Gemara says we'll have to put a dollar value on mitzvos, and we'll call it 10 gold coins. So the same way, if there's an actual mitzvah, and you deprive somebody else of doing that mitzvah, you have to pay 10 gold coins. So too, if you made somebody schlep out thinking there's a mitzvah, and it really isn't, so then you should compensate him the same rate. So that shows us that mitzvos stand in for monetary value. So normally, mecher means you do this and you get paid. So here we'll say you do this and you get spiritual points. You get a mitzvah. So therefore, says the Rashash, that's what Tosfos is getting at, that it's like mecher for that purpose. Yosef?
Are you compensating him for the time he spent, that he had to like travel, or that he
thought... In Chassam Sofer's case, I think that's the case. Chassam Sofer was all just mentioning that to illustrate the idea of quantifying the value of mitzvos, because why did this person schlep out to the supposed bris milah, right? However many hours it took him to get there, he came because he was motivated by a mitzvah. Turns out that was fraudulent. There was no mitzvah for him to do. So we should compensate him instead of the mitzvah that he came for, give him money instead. So that's just an illustration of what the Gemara says, that you pay that rate to somebody who loses an actual mitzvah. So here there was no actual mitzvah, but he should get paid for doing what he thought he was doing for him. So that's how the Rashash understands Tosfos. The Rashash, if you saw the Rashash, he doesn't fully explain this, but the Rashash refers to Gemaras, including the Gemara Nechulin. So that Gemara Nechulin is about Sar Zehuvim. So essentially that's what the Rashash is getting at, that you see that mitzvos are worth money, and therefore the difference normally between Mecher and Matana is that matana I give, I don't get anything, but mecher I give and I get money. So a mitzvah is like mecher, says Tosfos. And says the Rashash, it's because you're getting paid. You're getting paid spiritual points. You could have said differently. You could have said that it doesn't matter whether you're getting paid or not. The point is that it's considered to be something that you have to do, and therefore, for that reason, we put it in a category like mecher rather than matana. You could quibble about exactly what it means, but in any event, that's what Tosfos says, that there's justification for this being labeled a mitzvah rather than labeled a mecher rather than a matana. Just to give you another example of those two possibilities, there is a Gemara in Bava Kamma that the Gemara says that if somebody is a shomer aveda, let's say somebody finds lost property, so he has an obligation of shmira. He has an obligation to watch the lost property. So the Gemara says, we know there are different kinds of shomrim in halacha. We know there's a shomer sacher and a shomer chino. You could watch something for free, and then you have limited obligation and responsibility. Or you could watch something for pay, you're a shomer sacher, and then your obligations are more. So the Gemara in Hakones, in Daphne Zayin and Bava Kamma, the Gemara asks, if you find lost property and you're watching it, so you have an obligation to watch it, you're a shomer aveda, and nobody's really paying you on the surface. I don't know if they've advertised any rewards. Pashas, nobody's paying you. So should you be treated like a Shomer Chinam because nobody's paying you? Or should you be treated like a Shomer Sachar? So one answer, the Gemara has a couple possibilities about this, but one answer the Gemara says is we should treat him like a Shomer Sachar, like he's getting paid because Rachman and Meshabde. That the Torah forced him to do this. The Torah was Meshabed. So too, you could understand that the same two ways, I think. You could understand that as meaning either that the Schar Mitzvah is like being paid, that because he's being Mekayim and Mitzvah by doing this, he's like somebody's being paid in cash. Or we could say, no, it doesn't matter, he's not getting paid at all. But the Torah is obligating him to this standard, that the Chiyuv, the Mitzvah, means that he has a commitment as if he's being paid. So to here, I think this Tosfos could mean the same two things. It could mean that the mitzvah puts it in the mecher category, or like the Rashash is saying, that mitzvahs are valuable, and therefore it's like you're getting paid. So, is the Rashash, and is the Tosfos, with or without the Rashash, is the Tosfos saying something different than the Rashbam? Is there a machlokus between the two of them? I'm not sure. Okay, Arya?
I mean, I would just say that it's not that, according to Tosos, you're not just not losing out, you're actually gaining something.
Okay.
From this.
Okay.
If it's a mitzvah.
So essentially, it works because of the trade-off.
You have to actually receive something, not just not losing it.
Right. Although, so that's true, they're definitely highlighting different elements. So what I'm just not sure about is they could really go together. It's that the Gemara seems to put it in a category with Tzuvuzot. And the Rashbam and Tosfos are explaining two different components of that. That Tzlu V'Zavin works because of essentially a neutral trade-off. And that's the case here. And you might have thought that maybe it should be in the category of Mecher, so Tosfos is giving another explanation why it's not in the category of Matana, sorry, why it's Mecher rather than Matana. So it's two different ways of explaining maybe why it is a win-win, why there's no downside, but I don't know if fundamentally it's a different way of explaining how kfiyah works. They're both essentially saying that kfiyah works in the same category of tzvul v'zavin, and the Rashbam saying because you're not losing anything because it's a worthless marriage, and Tosfos saying that even more than that, that you're getting paid to do this because of the mitzvah. So the difference might be just in terms of which cases it explains. Like we said before, the Rashbam is a little bit difficult for a case where they don't have a worthless marriage, where the kfiyah is coming from something else, and the Tosfos' answer helps to explain most clearly when there's a clear mitzvah. And that if there is, for whatever reason, not such a clear mitzvah, then the logic may not fully apply. Nobody, did you ever hear that before? Somebody ever hear that? Okay. Nobody?
You answered my question.
Okay, excellent. So those are two of the statements so far that you find in the Rishon. The most famous of the views is, like we said before, is the Rambam. That's the Rambam we've already seen, but just to restate his position. So the Rambam highlights that even though we have a halacha of ratzon by the get, and somebody who's forced to give the get will say, what are you doing to me? This was against my will. I have no interest in actually doing this. So, says the Rambam, no, it's not true. Because he's got the pintle yid inside of him that everybody really wants to do what's right, but the Yetzer Hara or whatever other externalities get in the way. So here, we'll make sure that those externalities are not on his mind right now. We will allow him to focus on something else, and that will separate him from these other Yetzaharas, and then the true him will come out, and he'll be able to say, Rotsan. So this very often quoted explanation, so then again, that leaves us with a lot of questions just to figure out what's going on here. So first of all, one could ask, and this is something we'll have to spend more time on, so what is it that really makes it work? Right, is it the Rotsan? Or is it the fact that it's a mitzvah? Because the Rambam highlights both. And Rotsani, as we discussed yesterday, seems to be relevant to addressing the requirement of Ratzon. And even though it's not actually full free will, but because Dvarim Shebalei Veinam Dvarim, you're dealing with somebody else, so we can only deal with what's overt and that which is concealed. So that is effective. But then the question of the mitzvah, why do I need that? Why do I need the Rambam's whole explanation that the Pigdaliyot is there? Now, it could be that we're breaking things down into different components. And we're saying that on the one hand, so we have to make sure this transaction is valid on any level, because any transaction that doesn't have the two parties willing seems to be flawed. So we could say, well, that's addressed because he really does want to do this, the Pintaliyeh. And what about the requirement of Ratzon? Well, that's addressed through Rotzani being the official statement. Maybe you need both parts. And again, we'll still also have the question about what if Moos Alai, which the Rambam of Shitasa says also works, so what mitzvah is he premising himself on there in that case? That's going to be an important question to figure out. And why do we find distinctions between mitzvah and kviya in some circumstances? That'll also be something that we have to figure out. So, again, is the Rambam saying something fundamentally different than the way the Rashbam and the Tosfos were addressing the issue, or is he just explaining the mechanics from different perspectives, basically saying it's the same story, that this is a case of a tzluv hazavin, that if we pressure somebody to make a transaction, so at the end of the day, the transaction is good. And why is it good? Because that's really what he wants. So just like the Gemara says, by the merchandise, that even though you have the external monetary pressure to sell something, but once that's there, you decide to sell it. So to here, so this is really what he decided to do, because of the mitzvah, maybe. Some of the Nosei Kelim on the Rambam, they suggest that the makor for the Rambam from the Gemara might be the statement in the Gemara in Bava Basra of mitzvah l'shmoa devar chachamim, which Aryeh was just referencing. That line is in that Gemara that we're talking about today. And others explain that why is that not the clear source? Why do you have to say maybe that's the source? Because again, like you said before, the Gemara doesn't have to read that way. It's not 100% clear the Gemara is saying that the mitzvah is the motivational factor. The Gemara might just be saying that, well, transactions and gittin have that difference to them. So we don't necessarily know, so there is some discussion. Is that Gemara a source for the Rambam, or is it not? That's subject to discussion.
Hi. This might be more drushy, but the Gemara that says that Yimakno Sohad Shit Teitzei Nafsho, maybe the Rambam reads that it's until his true soul comes out.
Teitzei Nafsho.
Yeah,
it's
real soul.
Yeah?
Or is that real
drush? Well, I thought you were going to go further than that. I was going to say, Teitzei Nafsho, so it's Gilu, he's dead, and so she's an Almana, and then she's going that would really be a take away all his money, so it's only Chashit Kimeis, but that would really be a stretch. But I don't know, could be, you know, actually, you know, until his full soul comes out, you know, he says, this is what I want. Yeah, could be. That would put the two things together. We mentioned that some Gemaras you find, in some contexts, you find Kofen Hashem Merotzani, and some you say Kofen Hashem Teshanafsho. So you're saying both together, Teshanafsho, but Yom Merotzani, that's what it means. Merotzani means Teshanafsho, two synonyms. Okay. So
actually fit with some of his philosophy.
Sorry?
Matches. Fit with some of his philosophy.
Okay. Sounds good. All right. So there is what seems to be a fourth statement here in the Tshuvas of Rabbaz, which is also on today's list, but you probably didn't get to it yet, that the Rabbaz discusses whether or not kfiya is available in certain situations, which the situations he describes would really constitute what we would call abuse today. But the key factor that he has the reason to ask the question is because it's intermittent. That the Mishnayos on Ayin Zayin that we saw, so some of them discuss people who have certain permanent conditions, right? They have certain physical conditions or certain things they do for a living that makes it very hard to live with them practically. So there, says the Rabbaz, that's a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week kind of situation. So it might be that a woman would find it unbearable to live in such a situation. But people who have personalities where they are love-hate, like we've seen so many situations in real life like this, where one day they're hot, one day they're cold, one day the relationship's great, and one day it's terrible. So as difficult as that is over the long term, so the Rabbaz wasn't sure whether or not that's comparable to the cases that the Mishnayos discuss. And in that context, the Rabbaz basically asserts as we see from a couple of Gemaras that were also on today's list, that there is a concept of Afkeinu Rabbanan L'Kiddushin Minyan, that under some circumstances, the Chazal declare a marriage to be ineffective, to be null and void, which is a major, major question, what exactly that means, how it works, and when it works. And that's the subject we'll have to come back to later. But you saw it a little bit in today's Marokomos, as far as this context as well, that Chazal have, under some circumstances, an ability to essentially annul a marriage. Annul is a concept you find in the Catholic marriages. They don't believe in divorce, but they believe in annulment. The difference being that divorce is from here on in, the marriage was and now it's over, and annulment means that it never happened. The controversial topic within the Catholic Church. But here, so we believe in both, theoretically. So we have a concept of a get, of a divorce, and we have a concept of an annulment, which essentially, which when it applies is the question, but Afkeinu seems to be an annulment as opposed to a divorce. So the Radbaz essentially suggests that in these circumstances, that Chazal, since they reserve for themselves the right to decide what marriages are viable and which ones aren't, so therefore they removed their stamp of approval from this marriage, and that seems to annul it. And apparently that's how the Kfiyah works in this case. So essentially focusing on Ksupas Daf Ayin Zayin, the idea that there's Kfiyah by these circumstances, what the Rabbah is basically saying is that under these circumstances, Afkeinu Rabbanan L'Kiddushin Minyan, and therefore that's why Kfiyah is effective.
What's the purpose of the get?
So the get might just be essentially the outside mechanism in order for it to work, but the reason it doesn't need to be fully willing is not because of the other reasons that we've seen so far, but maybe because the marriage itself was disqualified at its core. So that seems to constitute a different position, but once again, there is room to say everything is different points along the spectrum. So I'll just mention one point, and then we'll have to continue this. But this, if you saw, is also on today's list, the Beis Yosef quotes a discussion about this point, that what would you say if a person was a Meshumet? Let's say if a person converted out of Judaism. So maybe in that case, we've been talking about the Pintel Yid, maybe such a person has disconnected his Pintel Yid. Not necessarily halachically, but functionally. Meaning that halachically, we believe you can't really convert out of Judaism. Yisrael afal pi shachati Yisrael hu. Is that fully true? There's a whole discussion. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein Shlita has a whole essay about this that was published in one of his English books about at what point is it possible for a person to be so immersed in another religion that he no longer has any connection whatsoever to Judaism halachically. But that question aside, so it seems to be, at least practically, it's safe to say this individual has absolutely no interest in observing the mitzvah satorah as a whole. I shouldn't say totally safe to say. I could see one questioning this, and you often maybe do hear stories of people who converted out and later find the Pintel Yid reconnecting them. So maybe there's room to argue on how accurate this statement is, but let's premise for a moment that somebody who's converted out of Judaism has essentially stated, sorry, I have no interest in fulfilling the mitzvah satorah. So does the Rambam's logic still apply to such a person? Can you still say kofenosot to give the get? So the Beis Yosef, which you'll see if you haven't seen it yet, it's on today's list, the Beis Yosef seems to assume that you can't. And the Beis Yosef quotes Maharik to assert another possibility. Basically that maybe Kfiya is not based on assuming the Pintel Yid wants it, but that Chazal neutralized the marriage. And the nafkamina being that if you have somebody who we know doesn't care, who we know doesn't have a Pintel Yid desire, maybe still it should work. That maybe for the Rambam it's not going to work, but maybe for the Ma'arik, as the Beis Yosef understands it, maybe it will work. But here as well, there are Achronim who debate the point, and the Sefer Kfiya Beget, there is a whole slew of Achronim on this side as well, who say they think that even the Rambam would agree that on the Shemot also you could have Kfiya by a get, and that ultimately it's all based on whatever philosophy, as he was pointing out, however we understand it, but ultimately, at the end of the day, our premise is that this individual is ultimately agreeing to do this. And that the Mishnah also, we could say that the circumstances are such that he is ultimately agreeing to do this. Which then, again, kind of plugs it right back into its full of his oven. And at the end of the day, there is a willing transaction, despite whatever had to happen beforehand, in order to bring it to that level. So with that framework, so we'll have to explore now how these various parts come together. So that's something, God willing, we will pick up next time we return to the sugya. But just to quickly review what we said today, so we discussed a few more basic premises, the fact that we find a mitzvah lagarish and kfiyah lagarish as two different categories, and that's something that we have to figure out what the implications are, both practically very important and conceptually very important. The idea that there's a requirement of bezdin smuchim, but there's also the functionality of shlichu sayu, and why do we need that? It's also something we'll have to try to figure out, that the Mishnayos here and a few Gemaras elsewhere in Yerushalmi also add to some more cases. So we have a number of cases from Chazal that kfiyah beget exists. The Rush and Shulchan Aruch Paskins like that says only in these cases. The Rambam very importantly asserts that Moed Salai is also involved. Others disagree. And that's subject to major debate. And then we discussed how the Rishonim understand what's going on. Four statements, we're not sure whether to call them four shitas, but four statements in the Rishonim as far as how the different components come together, many of them revolving around an important Gemara in Bava Basra and Daf Mem Ches, which says that sale is effective even if it's under pressure, and compares it to a get, makes important distinctions about what's free will and what's not free will as far as transactions, a lot of important elements from that Gemara, and we saw the different shittas from Rishonim, the Rashbam saying that essentially the guy's not losing anything because the marriage is worthless, and all he's doing is allowing her to remarry, which she shouldn't have any valid reason not to do. We discussed a little bit how that may evoke some of the terminology we find in Kofin al Midas Tom. It's interesting to compare the concepts, but there's also a weakness. What if the marriage is valuable but has some other problem, such as no children? That's a discussion we'll have to figure out. And then we saw Tosfos, that Tosfos asks, why is this not really a case of Matana rather than Mecher? Matana, it wouldn't work. So Tosfos says it's a mitzvah, and the Rasha Asha is mitzvah, meaning that you get paid, so you get spiritually paid, so therefore it's like Mecher. And we mentioned we could understand the mitzvah point to Tosfos in two ways, either that the spiritual points count like money, or that it doesn't matter, you're not getting paid, but the Torah is mitzvah, so therefore it's like an obligation such as the transaction of the sale. We compared it a little bit to the Gemara of Avakama about a Shomer Aveda, who's considered to be a Shomer Socher, because of the statement Rahman and the Shabde. Again, the same two possibilities as to what that phrase means. And then we saw the Rambam, that the Rambam says it's a Pinta Liyid that's coming out, and the whole discussion, how does that fit some of the other details, we'll have to say a lot more about that. But again, what is really motivating, what's the Rambam's operating system? First of all, is he addressing Rotzani as a key factor, or the mitzvah desire as a key factor? Is the source the Gemara in Bava Kamma that invokes mitzvah Shmoa Divrei Chachamim, or is that just there as a tchiyah of a different point that doesn't really define how this is really happening? That's also a question. And then we saw the Radbaz, who in his Chuvas distinguishes between abusive incidents, which are terrible but happen intermittently, as opposed to the cases in the Mishnah where there's a 24/7 type of situation. So maybe in those cases, afkein rabbanon with kedushin minei, and that seems to be how he understands it. And what might be a difference between the Rambam in a position like that might be a situation where the person has expressed having no pintaliyah. Let's say, for example, if he's a mishumad out of Judaism, so should we say that there's no premise to act on the Rambam? The Beis Yosef seems to think the Rambam would indeed say there's no such eitzah, but that the Maharik would consider it to be effective. And we discussed that some achronim, so the Rambam also said that no matter who he is, ultimately there is an agreement to go along with it, and that that's going to be effective. Okay, so we'll have a lot more to say about that, but we'll be sure about Mincha.